Welcome to the Jurisdictions Podcast. In this episode, Taylor Woodcock, PhD researcher in public international law at the Asser Institute, interviews Nanna Jansen at Reventlow, author and award-winning human rights lawyer, specialized in strategic litigation at the intersection of human rights, social justice, and technology. Founder of Systemic Justice and the Digital Freedom Fund, Nanny has overseen litigation worldwide, leading cases before national courts, the European Court of Human Rights, African Court on Human and People's Rights, and UN Human Rights Committee, amongst others. Nanny joins Taylor to explain strategic litigation, her trajectory in the field, and experiences working with marginalized communities in trauma-informed ways, providing practical insights and hope for the pursuit of material, structural change through strategic litigation. Enjoy.
Nanny, it's a pleasure to have you joining us today. And strategic litigation is really at the heart of the work that you do as a human rights lawyer. So to get us started, it would be great if you could speak to the listeners a little bit about what strategic litigation is.
Thank you so much for this wonderful question, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. It's wonderful to be here. Strategic litigation is using the courts or using legal processes in a way that pursues systemic change. In the work that we do at Systemic Justice, we look at it as a way that can help change law, it can help change policy, or it can help change practice. It's really about this idea that you bring about change that doesn't just concern the people who might be involved in a case. So you're bringing about change that is more structural, it's for a bigger group of people, and it's more systemic change, actually, that you're looking at. What makes litigation strategic is that it's embedded in a broader strategy. So it's not just about the court case. It's about making sure that what you do inside the courtroom actually ties up with other types of activism. So that could be advocacy work, it could be policy work, it could be raising public awareness, trying to generate a public debate or outrage about an issue. It's really about thinking about the bigger strategy for change that you are deploying to bring about, you know, this bigger shift in things. And what you're doing with the law is just one element of that that needs to kind of like work in synergy with those other elements.
It sounds like strategic litigation goes well beyond just the sort of things that we learn in law school. So I would be really curious to hear a little bit about your trajectory and how you got to break into this kind of work.
Yeah, my first kind of like engagement with strategic litigation came after I'd finished my training at the law firm. So I started after law school to first train with a big commercial law firm in the Netherlands. I did that for 4 years and 2 months. I counted exactly how long that took. I actually wanted to be a human rights lawyer, but it was really difficult to find, you know, human rights work straight out of law school without a lot of experience. So I trained at a law firm first and then was able to find a job with an NGO that's based in London that defends journalists and bloggers around the world. It's now called Media Defense. And this is where, for the first time, I came across strategic litigation as a tool for change and got the opportunity to be involved in like bigger freedom of expression cases in particular that actually helped to set standards that then other lawyers were able to use in litigation in other countries, in other courts, etc. So that was kind of the first time that I kind of saw like how beautiful like a chain of change you can create if you're lucky, and also if you have the right partners, obviously. That then became more or less a recurring kind of theme in my work. After my time at Media Defense, I moved on to spend a year at Harvard's Bergmann Klein Center to work there as a fellow on a project that looked at collaboration around strategic litigation, in particular to keep the internet open and free. So what I was exploring there is like, how can you make sure that lawyers work together with activists, with technologists, but also with academics to make sure that that they undertake are as impactful as possible? That was called the Catalyst for Collaboration project. And we essentially formulated with a group of litigators from around the world a set of best practices. So what are things to keep in mind when you collaborate with others around strategic cases? And we combined those with a number of case studies. Following that, I set up my first organization, the Digital Freedom Fund, which supports strategic litigation on digital rights in Europe. And that organization basically provided financial support to litigators across the Council of Europe area to undertake cases that can help, create greater protection for human rights in the digital context. And we also try to facilitate coordination and collaboration between different actors in that ecosystem. Having done that for nearly 5 years, I founded the organization that I'm running now, which is called Systemic Justice. A lot of that actually came out of the experience of supporting others in strategic litigation at the Digital Freedom Fund. But to make a longer story slightly shorter, our legal advisor at the Digital Freedom Fund, who was also the first head of legal at Systemic Justice, Jonathan McCulley, and I started to kind of like really notice a challenging dynamic looking at strategic cases that were supposedly undertaken on behalf of marginalized communities. And having reflected on that quite often at a certain point, we really started to think, okay, it should be possible to do this in a different way. And that is what led to the founding of Systemic Justice, really trying to build a different model of strategic litigation, one of community-driven litigation, where you really make sure that the marginalized groups, the communities that you're partnering with, are really in charge of the cases that concern them, which, as we were seeing, isn't often the case.
It sounds like, from your past experiences, being part of this chain of change and coordinating collaboration amongst different actors really has resulted in the work that you've been doing to engage communities to kind of address these issues that you flagged about how marginalized communities are represented within the context of strategic litigation. So it would be great to hear about some of your experiences on bringing cases on behalf of these communities, and also how you decide of when and where is appropriate to use courts to kind of get what you want, the result?
Those are both excellent questions. So the really short answer to that is like it's up to the community partners themselves. So the whole point actually of the methodology that we are building is to kind of move away from what I often refer to as a law first approach, where we as lawyers are very much trained, right? I also really want to acknowledge that this is not something because we're lawyers and therefore we're evil and we can only think about the law. Like from the moment that we go to law school, we're kind of like trained in this way in which we kind of see the law as a central point in the work that we do. We are also very much brainwashed into kind of like seeing ourselves as a bit as like gatekeepers in a way, right? We are the ones who understand how the law works. We are the ones who understand how legal systems work. And that kind of puts us in a bit of a special position. And it's quite hard to take yourself out of that. But that's something that we're really actively trying to do, really acknowledging that knowledge exists everywhere, can have many different shapes or forms, and that also communities themselves who are affected by injustice are the ones who actually know what the solutions are for those injustices. And that quite often means looking at things through a much broader lens, right? Than just, you know, this is a harm, this is a remedy, you know, we'll just pursue that and then we're done. And also justice is obviously a much broader and more complex concept than the law alone. So the way that we talk to our community partners and the conversations that we're engaging with them in are also therefore by nature much broader. It's getting clear from them, like what is their vision for change? What would things look like if things worked for them and their communities? Like what is this blue sky vision, so to speak, that they want to be working towards? What are the things that they're already engaging in? Are they already engaging in advocacy work? Are they raising public awareness? Are they campaigning, etc.? And then you actually start looking, okay, what are the ways in which legal processes, the courts, could fit into that to help catalyze the change that they're trying to bring about? And you then also look at a number of other factors, such as their capacity, to what extent certain choices would create additional risk or potentially additional harm for the community. Those are all things to think about. It's very important to work in a trauma-informed way to make sure that you don't kind of replicate harm or exacerbate it. And then you start looking at, okay, what are the different things that we could do? How would we sequence it, etc.? And you're then thinking again about much more than just one case, because you're looking at a longer period of time. We're acknowledging from the get-go that a bigger change just usually takes longer. It takes sustained work over a longer period of time. And it also, again, to make it strategic, right? It involves engaging different types of tactics at the same time. So you come to a much more comprehensive and longer term strategy. And a big important kind of like factor in that is the appetite for risk that the community partner has. And yeah, so here you're basically looking at a range from we, so to speak, it doesn't matter to us whether or not we win. We want to file a case that can really make a big splash, that can make big headlines and really grab the public's attention because no one is paying attention to this issue and they should. And if we file a big case, then the press is finally going to write about it and people are going to start talking about it. And that will hopefully spur on further action. On the other end of the spectrum, you can have a position where you're like, well, this is what one of our community partners said to us at some point. It's like, well, we don't want to lose anything because we don't want to give the party that we would be taking to court even an inch of a win, because that would just be ammunition for them, right, to further continue oppressing us. So then you have a tendency to undertake a really conservative legal strategy. That doesn't mean that you can't have a really big and bold narrative that comes with it, right? This is again this combination of what you do inside the courtroom and what you do outside of it. So you could have a super conservative legal strategy, be really risk averse, but still have a much bigger and bolder vision for the change that you want to see that you're communicating to a wider audience. And there's, tons of different levels in between. And it depends very much on the partner, what it is that they're trying to achieve, and also what their positionality is, again, when it comes to risk, harm, and all of those things, what might work best in a certain scenario.
So you've mentioned working closely with community partners. So how do you get in touch with these community groups who need this support? And what's the nature of that relationship? How do you try to make sure that you can work in trauma-informed ways? And also manage expectations, I guess, about, I mean, of course, there are limits to what strategic litigation can do and what you can do as a lawyer. So how do you manage that?
So when we started building this work, we knew that we wanted to work on racial, social, and economic justice in Europe through an intersectional lens across digital and non-digital issues. And that leaves you with a really, really, really long list of things that you could be working on, all of which are super urgent. And that basically brought us back to the very basic premise, right, of the work that we do is that communities should be in the lead. So we were like, okay, that's not up to us to decide as a team, like what we should be working on and what our priorities should be. We should be asking communities what it is that's most important to them. So we actually, rather than kind of like rushing to try and develop cases and building partnerships, we started with a community consultation process. So we invested a lot of time in listening and talking to people. They started with one-on-one conversations with activists that were in my network, who then introduced me to other people, who introduced me to other people, et cetera. So I ended up having, in the end, 100 one-on-one conversations with people who were all engaged in different types of activism on different issues. Trying to understand better, like what an organization like this could do for them, what it should do, what it shouldn't do, what role the law already played in their work at this point in time, or why they weren't engaging with it. Just really try to understand better, like what the people's experiences had been so far. Then it was a bit like, okay, that's all nice, one-on-one conversations, but we should open it up to all these people that haven't spoken to. So we set up a survey in different languages to kind of get similar input. Got also again like nearly 100 submissions to that. And then we were like, okay, we should actually make sure that we talk to lots of people across the region. We should organize roundtable conversations. And this was just, so this was in 2022. So we were just kind of getting out of lockdowns and so on. So this was all still online. which made it a lot more manageable to organize for a young and not yet very well funded startup organization. So we wanted to bring people together around six themes that had come up in the conversations that we'd had so far, and organize roundtables, so Europe-wide roundtables around those topics. So we looked at six different topics: at climate justice, at access to justice, at social protection, policing, free movement, and anti-racism. On each of these topics, we had between 15 and 20 activists from around the Council of Europe area together in the space to look at the issues that they were firefighting on at the moment, but also the solutions that they saw. What were the opportunities for change that they saw? In parallel with that, we did a big mapping across the region to see what type of strategic litigation was currently being undertaken on these different topics. Putting those two together, it became clear that two issues were both like really important for community groups, but underserved by strategic litigation at this point in time. And this is how we ended up working on climate justice and on social protection as our initial thematic focus areas. Climate justice for us is the intersection between the fallout of the climate crisis and racial, social, and economic justice. And social protection means housing, healthcare, education. So, all those areas where governments should be providing access to essential services, but is doing A, less and less so, and B, less and less so, particularly when it comes to marginalized groups. And so, those are the areas in which we're currently in conversation with community partners to build cases. Those relationships, because that's what you were asking, like what do those partnerships look like? They are really long-term partnerships. The idea is that, we're in it for the long run. Systemic change is challenging. It takes a long time, and you have to be ready to partner for a longer period of time. So we really consider ourselves as long-term partners of the communities that we work with. We're kind of their law firm. So we consider ourselves a bit as a law firm for movements and for community groups. And we make sure that throughout that partnership, whatever legal work comes up and that fits in a strategy that we create under the leadership of the community partner gets operationalized. It's really important, especially with longer term partnerships, to be really realistic, right, when you go into them. Strategic litigation definitely isn't a silver bullet to fix things. You can win inside the courtroom and not get the change show up on the ground, right? The same way that the other way around, you can lose in a courtroom but still make the change happens. It can go both ways. But it's also long work. Quite often, courts can be slow, right? It's also important to manage expectations on how quick change will materialize. So where we actually start those conversations is actually with a really basic exchange about strategic litigation. What is it? What is it not? What can it do for your campaign for change? What can it not do? So that people really understand what expectations they can have, but also what opportunities it can bring. And that is work that we do with communities at large. So not just the ones with whom we end up working in partnership eventually. That is part of one of the strands of our work. It's called our Building Knowledge and Power work, in which we actually want to make sure that as many communities as possible understand what strategic litigation is, what it can do for them, what the limitations are, that they're able to have conversations within their community groups on whether or not this is something they want to explore. And we've created a beautiful toolkit, again, based on a consultation on what people would find helpful, that, for example, includes a conversation starter. So it's like a number of really easy questions that you can take to your community to discuss these things with, but also a guide that, by means of a lot of really practical examples from activism, shows what strategic litigation can do for campaigns. And Words for Justice, it's called, which is actually an explainer of complicated legal jargon in normal human speak by taking people through a process and actually explaining, like, what are all these words that people are throwing around at different stages of the litigation.
When you're working on behalf of communities, I can imagine that they're not necessarily all homogenous and that there might be different interests within those communities. So have you ever been in a situation where you had to address competing interests, or whether you experienced pushback from within the community itself, and how would you navigate that?
That's a really important point, like that, you know, and communities can show up in very different ways, right? What defines a community is very context specific. It could be based on locality or geography. It could be based on shared experiences or shared identities. Could be all sorts of things. And yeah, that also means that there could be very different perspectives within what is, you know, labeled as quote unquote a community. In the way that we work with community partners, those issues about like who is involved in what and who is going to be taking potential litigation work further, who are going to be more closely involved in the longer term partnership, are things that are actually quite early stage in the conversation. Because before you even get to, I don't know, drafting a legal brief, you need to have had really important conversations about how are decisions going to be made within this collaboration. If there's an emergency, like who's going to be able to say yes or no to something? What are the accountability mechanisms that we want to work with in those contexts? Like who's accountable to whom and how are we going to operationalize that, etc. And we've had situations where where you would kind of like have different layers, right, within a much larger community that shared a bigger geography, for example, so a part of a city or a neighborhood or something like that, and then you had different layers within that. And in certain situations, it's quite possible to say like, okay, there's a smaller core group, or there's a smaller unit within the broader community that is going to be working on the litigation partnership. And the rest are going to be involved in a supportive way, right? They're not going to be parties to it, or they're not going to be deciding on the exact strategy in the case, but they will amplify any communications around the case, for example, or they will contribute by linking to things in their campaigning, etc. So there's different ways in which you can navigate that. It's not, it's quite unworkable, I guess, like in practice to just work with an amorphously large group. So you always need to have those conversations about like who represents whom within which groups, who gets to make decisions and who is accountable to whom. And this can be tricky things. And actually sometimes that those are actually things that you spend a lot of time on in the beginning to get clear, but it's really crucial because otherwise you'll run into trouble further down the line.
Could you give an example of a situation where you might win in a courtroom but not get the outcome that you're seeking, or vice versa?
There's been some really, really powerful litigation in Central and Eastern Europe around school segregation, particularly when it comes to children from the Romani community. Equal access to education is not the current situation there. And unfortunately, that's still not the current situation because it's been litigated in a number of national courts and even up to international level successfully, but the change on the ground still hasn't taken place. So that's school segregation is still unfortunately very much a fact today. There's often like questions as to like why doesn't that happen? Well, people in power will resist, right? Even in a lot of countries where we think that we kind of like that courts have the authority that they should in making sure that power holders can be held accountable. And implementation work is really long and hard work quite often that requires, in effect, like a whole new project. That's, you have the project around the case that you're building, winning it, etc. And then the implementation is actually a whole new project in and of itself because it doesn't happen naturally. And I think here there's also a lot of systemic conditions that don't help quite often, right? Because when you look at resourcing and you look at a lot of this work comes from civil society and civil society organizations that actually work on those types of litigation with communities, there's often enthusiastic support, funding, and excitement around filing a case, around winning a case, but then actually making sure that that work can be sustained to get to implementation is a lot harder.
Even when strategic litigation leads to legal reform, individuals may not see it or be motivated to change behaviour. So what advice would you give for those wanting to engage in strategic litigation in order to ensure that a positive outcome in the courts has the best chance of leading to material change outside of them?
I think that this is part indeed of like thinking through like your broader strategy and what should be brought in which different points. And I think what you're asking also touches upon a really important point of thinking much more broadly about what it is that you're asking a court to do when you file your case. And there tends to be quite limited creativity actually there. And also, I think sometimes people also are perhaps a little bit reluctant to come across as too directive, perhaps for towards a judge or something like that. Obviously, a lot of it is about the way in which you present it, but like, yeah, I think that in this specific case, like something that I would kind of think might be a little bit outside the box is maybe you annex like a draft, a piece of legislation. It's like, here, this is what it could look like, or these are the elements that we would be thinking of. And a judge can decide to follow that or not, but at least you will have brought it into the conversation, right? And I think it's not just about like those really concrete technical things that you might want to see. In many cases, it's also about like what's the broader context that's going to help bring about quote unquote justice, which to a large extent also could entail things such as acknowledgement of harm done, commemoration, non-repetition, right? Which we quite often ask for. How are you actually going to make that happen? Well, maybe the particular government body that kept on committing these human rights harms should undergo training in these specific things. So it's really thinking a bit more broadly, like, okay, what does a situation look like if we were to have justice, and what is actually needed to bring that about? And that's quite often a lot more than just a general order or some reparations ordered or apologies, whatever, those sort of things. What is a broader range of measures that could be taken?
So on the venues, then, the courts for this kind of strategic litigation work, how do you make those choices about where you're bringing the cases, and what sort of courts are you mainly working with?
That's a great question, which is to which I could give a very lawyerly answer, which is like it all depends, because it does depend on the particular issue that you're trying to address, right? And overall, because we work with very local community partners, quite often litigation starts at the lowest level in a national context. It could also be that there's an issue that would benefit from first kind of like taking it to a complaints mechanism, but overall you start with the lowest level local court, not necessarily with the ambition to only have it decided, you know, at the international level, which is a very traditional view, particularly when you look at the international NGO sector. Like the idea is like you kind of have to make your way through the national courts, and then you can go to the European Court, or you can go to a UN human rights body or the Court of Justice of the European Union to really kind of start talking human rights. I think there's something in there again about like looking at justice in a slightly broader, through a broader lens, right? And just human rights. But also acknowledging that a lot of the change really has to come from the communities themselves. So it has to kind of start really close to where they are. And then, you know, you can, if it's needed, kind of go up levels in appeal and et cetera. And at some point, maybe even go internationally. But there's something there about that really essential connection with the people who the case concerns, right? And making sure that it stays close to them and that they really keep on having that feeling of control and of ownership of the legal work that is being undertaken. So it could be that it's just a civil law dispute. It could be an administrative complaint. It could be all sorts of things. It's not a given that it immediately is framed as a human rights issue first and foremost. We have conversations ongoing with partners where technically you would be looking at things such as like urban planning, or you would be looking at air pollution levels, or you'd be looking at oversight of ingredients in beauty products. So it's those are very different types of mechanisms that would be overlooking those aspects, and therefore also very different venues that you would go to.
So, by the sounds of it, the work that you do with systemic justice goes well beyond a kind of traditional human rights lawyer role in really centering communities. So, it would be great to hear a little bit more about how you started this organization and how you kind of built it to where it is today, and also the kinds of colleagues that you have there, because as we've discussed, it's a lot more than traditional lawyering going on. So it would be really great to hear a bit more about how you managed all that.
Having worked very much as a traditional NGO lawyer in the beginning of my career, and then setting up an organization that supported others with strategic litigation, you get like a really nice overview, right? You get a lot of people coming to you with ideas for cases, and you start seeing patterns. And in the work that we did at the Digital Freedom Fund in supporting strategic litigation on human rights in a digital context, we were seeing this recurring pattern of lawyers coming to us with project proposals that related to marginalized communities. So, for example, a group would come to us saying, like, okay, there's this legislative proposal in our country that is really harmful to migrants. And we'd be looking at the proposal and we'd be like, but where are the migrants, or where are organizations that actually represent migrants' interests in this project plan? So we'd start asking questions and be like, okay, where are the people who are affected by this bill? We're like, no. We first want to develop the legal strategy, and then we'll start talking to the communities that are affected. And we'd be like, well, how about we switch things around? We provide some extra funding, and you consult with people first so that you can pursue an outcome that actually makes sense to them. And this came up more and more often. Up to even a very extractive dynamic where, with things changing very much in our society due to the involvement of technology, you would see community groups who've been working on issues for a long time that were first quote unquote analog, and then because of technology became a digital rights issue. And you'd get lawyers like literally swooping in and being like, oh, okay, this interesting case, I'm going to take this forward. And they would just basically run off with it. And yeah, actually leaving the communities who've been working on these issues for a really long time completely behind. And that led to a lot of reflection within our team, and especially between the senior legal advisor that we had at DFF at the time and myself, about how difficult this was to see. And actually, at some point, a bit of frustration. I'm like, okay, it should be possible to do this differently. Like, why are we all working this way, right? And that led to the idea of building systemic justice and as an organization that really tries to do that in a different way. For us, that has been quite a journey, right? It wasn't that we, saw the first difficult application at DFF and right away we're like, okay, everything should be different. Like, it takes a long time to kind of realize what the pattern is that you're seeing, and also to be able to start formulating what different actually looks like, right? And the way that we're trained as lawyers doesn't help there. And that kind of gets continuously reinforced also by our peers. So it really requires, yeah, a lot of unlearning, I guess, as lawyers. That also means that the work that we're building actually doesn't center so much around lawyers as you would think for an organization that's kind of a law firm for movements. Many of the members of our legal team are actually focused on community organizing and supporting our community partners rather than really kind of like the legal fine points. Obviously, we understand like how the law works, but it's particularly about understanding how the law works in a broader strategy for change, and how can you use it to leverage strengths that are already present, and how can you build the right kinds of partnerships to reinforce the work that is being undertaken. So that makes it different in and of itself, like composition wise. But also another thing that we thought about very carefully from the beginning is the need to make sure that our work is really rooted in foundational values. So we work based on the foundational values of anti-oppression, intersectionality, and justice, with the idea that we can't show up as the right kinds of partners that actually are working in service of communities if we don't do that work internally as well as an organization. You can't be one organization on the outside and a different one on the inside. So that means that we're continuously reflecting on, like, how can we work in an anti-oppressive way? What does intersectionality mean? Also for the way that we do our operations. What does justice really look like in a much more holistic sense?
How have you experienced finding economic support for your mission? And what about pushbacks?
That's an excellent question, and resourcing is a crucial one, right? For especially for longer term work, and there's also a lot to consider about who can even access funding, right? So we're incorporated as a stifting, as a nonprofit organization in the Netherlands. We tick all the boxes, right? We have a proper governance structure. We have a well-known nonprofit entity type, and we meet all the regulations, all the formalities, etc. And then, there's a lot of the partners that we work with who make a deliberate choice to not incorporate because they don't want to become part of the system, which actually is also one of the things I write about in the book, that it can be a really big distractor, right? Like, you end up spending time, like, dealing with all your formal regulations and your setup and your governance and all of those things, all time that you could be spending, doing activist work and making change. The bureaucratization of resistance work is a really big issue. So that just first as a point to make. And then the landscape has dramatically changed, the funding landscape has dramatically changed since we started. So I started having those conversations with people in 2021. I started working full time on building the organization in 2022. 2021, still like a little bit of the afterglow, right, of 2020, BLM, George Floyd protest, etc. All the funders wanted to be seen to be supporting racial justice work. There was tons of money, tons of interest in supporting movements, and just general kind of like anti-oppression work. And 2021, it started to kind of like simmer down a little bit. And actually, as we started building the organization, that started turning into a backlash, like an outright backlash, where you saw a lot of the foundations that before were very much like, yes, we're all on our learning journey to understand social justice and anti-racism, to actually, well, you get the dog whistles then about, like, oh, we don't want to do such political work. And those sorts of narratives. And that actually made it quite challenging to build the initial support for the work. And now that we see the increasing turn towards the right, and in the US towards fascism, and the knock-on effect that something like defunding USAID has on the overall philanthropic landscape, it's just gotten worse. The political landscape hasn't helped either. It just kind of like, when the European elections turned out the way that they did, that also seemed to embolden a lot of the more traditional foundations in this narrative about apolitical work. Fortunately, not everyone looks at it that way. Where we've been able to build good collaborations is particularly with foundations that are interested indeed in supporting communities, that are interested in movement work, or who are interested in some of the thematic things that we do. Strategic litigation, unfortunately, for a lot of foundations, is really complicated. It shouldn't be, I always say, like, it's just as tangible as a social media campaign or whatever. You can set up metrics, you can do all sorts of things, you can budget for it just fine. But for some reason, there's still a lot of hesitancy around that. But We've been able to find, fortunately, a number of good partners who do understand, that it takes longer, that slower work, right, to kind of like work on systemic change, that it's slower work to work at the pace of the community partners themselves, that those are things that you can't rush because it has to be a really trust-based relationship, and that really kind of are okay in kind of giving us that space to build that work with the care that it requires. There's also a bunch that like think they want that, and then after 2 years, like there are no cases. Okay, like bye. it comes with the territory. So there is you need to have a certain degree of, I guess the positive way of putting it is tenacity or stubbornness. Stubbornness is also how you could put it, to kind of keep at it and keep on having those conversations. I have to say there that engaging in those conversations and in those spaces, which to a large extent are quite white spaces, where if there's any learning at all about positionality and so on, that's quite often in very early stages. I found them at times very wearing to engage in that. So it also requires, figuring out ways to kind of like balance that out in a way that it doesn't become all consuming, right? You have to kind of both lean into it, but at the same time try and keep a bit of distance. What I do think is that we've been lucky to build a number of really good relationships, and also due to the previous organization that I ran was a re-grantor, right? So that also meant that we were more in funder spaces. Some people listen to you, which is good. It also kind of was just talking about spheres of influence as well. I'm also thankful for the fact that that has given me a window to be able to advocate for things that would also benefit the community partners that we work with, who currently actually are really not served by the system at all. Like I might find it challenging, right, to engage in the funding landscape as it is, but I get to participate in the first place, and that's not a given for all of the organizations that we work with. So I also try to use that access to create access for others, if that makes sense. But there's still such a long way to go.
So moving away from the technical specifics related to domestic litigation, in what sense could we think about your work as part of an international movement?
I look at that, and I guess at two different levels. So one is, like, as you were just sketching, there's the specifics, the technical specifics about local work, and by that I do not only mean the legal technical specifics, but also culture, context, all of those things that make campaigning work or strategies that include strategic litigation go in a certain direction. On the other hand, you have so many issues that are just, I'm hesitating to use the word universal, but what I really saw in those conversations I had, the one-on-one conversations I had with people, and then after that also in the roundtables, the tactics of oppression that are being used are actually the same. They might manifest themselves with like slight tweaks, but in the end, like whether we were talking, we were having a conversation about anti-Black racism, if we're talking about Islamophobia, if we're talking about persecuting Romani communities, like it's always like over-policing, it's over-surveillance, it's lack of access to decent housing, healthcare, education, etc. It's the same. So the tactics are the same. So there's still a lot then there in resisting that oppression that can be shared across both different communities and also across different jurisdictions. And there, I actually think that there's more than anything, there's just like a lot of potential actually, especially in a region like the Council of Europe that still wants to look at itself as some, in some shape or form, coherent, right? where you could look at like, okay, indeed, what are the best chance of success for a case that would actually finally address the issue of impunity of police murders, for example? Where can we kind of like give things such a push that we get that ball rolling so that that precedent can finally start hopping over to other jurisdictions, which are then the tactics that we can adapt based on local context, etc. You know, that is always a question that you need to ask. But I do think, especially when you include strategic litigation as part of your broader strategy for change, that that is a very that's a very fruitful avenue to pursue, because quite often you do see, you know, judges are humans, you know, and they will look at what their colleagues do, and if someone else has taken that first step, that lowers the threshold so significantly. You see it right now all around you when you look at the climate cases that are there, right? You see that there's this kind of like accelerator effect almost, because good decisions are coming out all over the place and people are feeling emboldened, they're feeling encouraged, they're feeling, yeah, it's less hard, let me put it that way, to make a climate positive decision as a judge now than it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So I think that that is something that could happen for a lot of issues.
So particularly in the current moment in history that we find ourselves, where there can be a lot of resistance to structural change and some corresponding pessimism and lack of trust in policy and in law. So in that context, what makes you really motivated to discuss about the power of strategic litigation and how it can intervene when human rights protections do seem to be continually kind of drawn back and constrained?
Yes, the current times make you pessimistic about so many things, and I'm not yet pessimistic about the courts. I actually quite often at the moment make the case for the courts being a very fruitful avenue in a context where we seem to be regressing on many fronts, especially in countries where the judiciary is not composed of political appointments. There's still a lot of hope that we can have of making sure that that injustice is actually addressed in the courtroom. This is not to kind of like say like, okay, let's all just be really naive and the courts are going to save the day. But at the same time, I've also had a lot of experiences where unexpectedly, also in settings where you might not think that it would happen, really, really strong judgments in favor of human rights have come out of courtrooms, even in settings where the overall political climate was quite repressive. So I always say, like, you know, you have to give the courts the opportunity to actually decide in your case and to actually take action to find in your favor. That is, they can't do anything unless you bring cases to them, right? And I think that right now we still have a really, really, really good window in many places. And yeah, we should benefit from it, actually, all the more so, I would almost say, until we are also able to turn around the political landscape into the direction that it should be going.
And do you have some advice for either people starting a career in law or human rights, or who more generally just want to help contribute to bring about a better world and kind of affect systemic change, on how to engage with communities and how to do this sort of work? Because you mentioned that the start of your career was in the corporate sector and you went through kind of NGOs. So I'm just curious to hear about that.
Yeah, this is a really, really good question because it's really hard to answer, actually. This is the problem, right? We as lawyers are working with the master's tools, definitely very firmly placed inside the master's house, to reference Odur Lorde's famous essay. And it's something that I've struggled with for a really long time also, like this idea that you want things to fundamentally change, and at the same time, the tools that you're using to bring about change are reinforcing those power structures that you're trying to dismantle, right? I've come to the position that it's two things at the same time. One is like trying to figure out like what could different systems look like. How can we imagine a different legal system, one that is not rooted in, the white supremacist patriarchal foundations that our current system is rooted in. And at the same time, we have this one. And as long as we have this one, it needs to work better for everyone. So we need to do what we can in that context to make that change while not letting go of that vision, right? Of actually a fundamentally alternative system. And here, each of our positionality comes into play very prominently. We'll have different amounts of leverage to change things at different stages of our careers, in different phases of our working life. But I think that the main thing I would kind of like encourage people to do is to always investigate that, always to examine that, and to never underestimate the power that you have. So one example that I often gave when I still trained lawyers on freedom of expression cases is that also as a litigant before a judge, you have power to quote unquote educate the judge. You should never tell the judge that you're educating them, obviously, but the things that you bring in, the way in which you present the jurisprudence that you rely on, the perspectives that you bring in are all ways in which you can shift a mindset, right? So there's a lot of strategy around that, obviously. Like, how do you make sure that things actually land? And I always think that's the fun bit also about litigation. It's about how can you piece things together in such a way that you will minimize resistance and optimize for things to actually land and things to go your way. But there's a lot that you can do in that context, and there's lots of other people that you can bring in to help make the case for you. There's experts, there's, et cetera. So it's about like not underestimating the flexibility that you actually have, even when it looks like you have a very cordoned off role in a process. There's quite often still a lot more that you could do.
Nani, in addition to being a human rights lawyer and the founder of Systemic Justice and the Digital Freedom Fund, you're also an author. And your book, Radical Justice, which is published in Dutch and soon will be in an English language edition too. What moved you to write this book? And if you could give us a word on what the key message of it is that you want to share.
Well, it was actually by chance that I got to write this book. It was really, I was very lucky. I'd written an op-ed about reparations in Dutch newspaper, NRC Handelsblad, basically questioning why we always keep on talking about research and commemoration and so on, but actually keep on shying away from the payment conversation. And also flagging that there are many ways in which colonial legacy is present in our current power structures in society and manifests itself in many ways that could be addressed in the here and now. And I was very lucky that someone read the op-ed and basically sent me an email and said, like, gosh, would you like to write a book about reparations? And I was like, well, I don't think I'm a reparations expert. To be honest, I'm not quite sure I could write a whole book about that. But what I have been thinking about that it might be nice to write a collection of essays about different topics that I think are important for all of us to reflect on a bit more deeply. Unfortunately, he also thought that that was a good idea. So this is how I got to write the book. So Radical Justice covers both a number of thematic issues that I've worked on in the past, so and currently work on. So on climate justice, digital rights comes in, freedom of expression, obviously. Reparations is also an essay about that, but also some of the more cross-cutting issues that we see, right, in civil society. So the concept, for example, about of hero worship that we quite often see in movements, this idea that we need this mythical leader to, bring us salvation rather than recognizing the power that each of us has to actually make change. And another thing that I really make a strong case for is the need to remain really ambitious in the change that we're pursuing in the world. The title of the book is derived from Angela Davis's quote that radical simply means grasping things at the root, that you really need to understand root causes in order to make bigger change, but that it's really, you know, you have to kind of like hang on to this idea that you can change things and that you can change bigger power structures as well. So, and that kind of like, I guess, brings me also to what I hope that the book does. I am trying to, for each of the topics that I address, to really look at the root causes of the injustice that we're seeing, but not leave it there. On each topic, I give a lot of examples of activism from around the world. How have other groups dealt with certain issues? What are the changes that they are pursuing? What are the tactics that they're using? There's a very prominent place, obviously, for strategic litigation as a tactic within the book, and a chapter that's indeed also called, like, you know, the master's tools that's specifically dedicated to that. But each chapter also gives the reader pointers to what they can do next. And that means that I give suggestions on things to further read or listen to, questions to reflect on, and yeah, small first steps that people can take. My main argument actually is that we can each engage in activism within our sphere of influence. We don't all have to do the same big dramatic things. The way that we imagine activism sometimes is, you know, all the things that we see on TV and in the movies and so on. But it can be really small things also. And we each have our own spheres of influence in the different spaces that we operate. And it's about, again, examining in those spaces, what is the leverage that I have? What is the difference that I can make here? And that will change over time. So this is why this kind of has to be a really, it's muscle that you need to build. And it can start very small and it become bigger. And it's just about finding those things that you can sustain for a longer period of time. As we need everyone to do their bit, we all need to do different things because change is something that only can be brought about if we really take multifaceted action all together.
Thank you so much, Nani, for sharing your experiences and your insights on all of the work that you do for community-centered strategic litigation and how we can think about even the small changes towards systemic justice and change. So if anybody wants to hear more about your work, where can they find that information? And are there any new projects on the horizon for you?
So both I and Systemic Justice can be found on social media, and we have nice websites and so on, but we're on LinkedIn and on Instagram. And two things that I will be excited to share about through those channels in the near future are a new book, which I co-edited, which is called Intersectionality and Human Rights, which reimagines European Court of Human Rights case law through an intersectional lens. So with a group of authors that are both activists, but also academics and practitioners and so on, we've reimagined a set of recent European Court of Human Rights judgments and rewritten them as they could have been decided had the court applied an intersectional lens to them. And in March, the English edition of my book, Radical Justice, will come out as well. There's a website for that as well. It's called radicaljusticebook.com, where there will be updates and you can sign up for updates there as well. So yeah, it'll be a launch event there and hopefully other opportunities to engage.
And we can have those links in the show notes of the podcast. But this was a really wonderful conversation. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
And as always, thank you for listening to the Jurisdictions podcast. If there's a specific international legal issue, concept, or case that you, the listener, would like us to cover, please write to us at jurisdictions@assa.nl.